The Salamonster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Seth, you haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 305 of the Salamonster Sounds Off for Saturday, December 14th, 2013. I am the Salamonster here on a snowy Saturday here in New York. I don't know what it's doing where you guys are, but I know a good part of the country here is blanketed in snow. Even parts of the world, they had snow in Jerusalem earlier today. So wherever you are, hopefully if you like the snow, you're enjoying it. And if you don't, you're inside like I am. You can download this podcast every week in full on thesalamonster.com. That's our official website. You can also stream us online in Stitcher Radio and subscribe to the show in iTunes. Speaking of Stitcher, for those of you who don't know, Stitcher is hosting their 2013 awards, and nominations are open now. So if you want to nominate the Sound Off for a possible Stitcher award, you can do so if you go to stitcher.promotw.com. So stitcher.promotw.com. You may have to like their official page on Facebook and all that stuff, but once you get in there, there's a whole bunch of different categories, including Best Overall Show. You can vote for the Sound Off there. But the category that you want to vote in is Best Sports Commentary. That is the, you know, we're listed on the sports charts there on Stitcher every week, hovering around the top 10, top 15. So if you want to nominate the Sound Off for a possible Stitcher award, you can do so in the Best Sports Commentary category. The way it works is you start typing in the full name of the show. There'll probably be a little drop down that pops up. Click the Sound Off, click Submit. You can nominate us in as many categories as you want, but that's the main one. And you can also vote as much as you want, once a day, every day, between now and next Sunday, December 22nd. So I just wanted to mention that here. If you want to help the Sound Off out, stitcher.promotw.com, and you can nominate us for those awards. I also want to say thank you here early on to Anthony McGregor, Hunter Palmer, Adam Misaglia, Anthony Obasi, and Richard Elwanger, who made PayPal donations to the Sound Off this past week. I am greatly indebted to each of you, and if you want to make a PayPal donation, you could do so on thesalamonster.com. For those of you who missed it, I recorded a 90-minute exclusive Q&A for the TV Tracks channel on YouTube last week. It went up shortly after episode 304 did, answering all kinds of questions from the listeners on that channel. TV Tracks has been a big supporter of this podcast for a number of years, so I wanted to do something fun, an exclusive thing just for his listeners. That's up on the TV Tracks channel right now. All kinds of questions. Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania 30, Shawn Michaels flopping around and making Hogan look foolish at SummerSlam, my Hall of Fame class for 2014, if I had the chance to put people in, who that would be. All that and a bunch more. So go on TV Tracks, watch the video. It's their featured vid right now. It's up there. You can like the video, leave comments, and it's like a bonus Sound Off. So if you missed it, go back and check that out. Tickets for Monday Night Raw, the night after WrestleMania next year, went on sale officially to the public this morning, and they sold out. They're all gone. So if you were hoping to go to the Raw after Mania and you didn't get your ticket this morning, you may be out of luck, because I don't know when they may release some more tickets as we get closer. But otherwise, unless you got yours this morning, looks like you're going to be shut out, which is a shame because I've been to the post-Mania Raw the last 2 years, first in Miami and then New Jersey this year, and I have to say, two of the most fun experiences I have ever had at any event, wrestling or otherwise, ever. Those crowds are awesome. There's a lot of international people who come into town for the pay-per-view, and they stick around an extra night. And so I'm sure in New Orleans next year it won't be any different. I'm looking forward to it. I may be looking forward to that show more than WrestleMania itself. And yet, I'm paying five times the amount of money on my WrestleMania ticket that I did for Raw. It just seems kind of ass backwards, but it is what it is. Speaking of Raw, last Monday night was the Slammies in Seattle. It was the Daniel Bryan show. They were in his home state of Washington, which meant they went crazy for him the entire night. Seattle, you rock. Not as much as we did in New Jersey the night after Mania, but still, one of the best crowds all year. Speaking of which, you can now refer to me as the Slammy Award-winning host of the Salamonster Sounds Off, because that crowd won the Slammy for best crowd of the year. I'm sure my award is in the mail on its way to me as we speak. Bryan ended up winning a total of five awards: Superstar of the Year, Double Cross of the Year, Best Couple, Best Beard, and Fan Participation for the Yes Chant. And the crowd completely hijacked the main event segment to send WWE a message. That message being, we don't give a shit about John Cena versus Randy Orton at TLC. We want to see Daniel Bryan. And I loved it. It was great. I thought it was one of the best segments on Raw, not only of the year, but in many years. I don't know where it ranks, but it's up there. And we'll get to that in a second. But first, a few other slammy notes. Bryan did win Superstar of the Year, although apparently the vote was very close from what I read. I'd have to think John Cena was a close number two. It was presented by Shawn Michaels, the man who kicked Bryan in the face 2 months ago. There was some tension there, you know, he handed the slammy over to Bryan, wouldn't let go, and they played it up for about 10 seconds. But no angle. That's pretty much all there was. There was no angle to set up a match, you know, or anything like that. Bryan did hit Michaels with a flying knee in the final segment, and it certainly set up a match between the two at WrestleMania. Then, when he did that, it certainly set that up if they wanted to go in that direction. But I still believe Michaels when he says he's retired, he's done, he's not wrestling again. I believe him. I actually believe the guy. The Bella Twins won Diva of the Year, which was highway robbery, and the fans in Seattle knew it. They crapped all over these two women. I don't see how the Diva of the Year could be anybody but AJ Lee. She got screwed harder than Justin Bieber in a Brazilian brothel. Okay, you can't tell me that promo she cut on the Total Divas women where she eviscerated them and insinuated that they had to blow their way to the top wasn't one of the best things all year on Raw. Easily one of the best things. The Rock concert with Rock insulting Vicky Guerrero won LOL Moment of the Year. A fine choice, I have no problem with that, but Brodus Clay calling himself a main eventer or the battleground buy rate would have made better choices. I can go either way. And the match of the year went to John Cena versus The Rock at WrestleMania 29, another choice the crowd did not approve of. John Cena had no choice but to acknowledge it even. He said, well, I know some of you may disagree, but obviously some of you like that match, so thank you for the award. And he walked off. I mean, how could you not? How could you not acknowledge that, you know? The category was a joke to begin with, but I just have to remind myself, the Slammys are not real awards, just like the Hall of Fame isn't a legit Hall of Fame. It's a figment of a madman's imagination. They are what WWE wants them to be. That said, everybody seems to think the voting was rigged. You know, I was commenting and live tweeting during the show, and everyone's like, enough, it's rigged, it's not real. Now, for what it's worth, WWE insists the voting was 100% legit. And I don't know if it is or it isn't. It's not like they bothered giving us the percentage totals for each award. Now, it's just them announcing who won, like they do at the Oscars or the Emmys. We have to take their word for it. It's a free app people use to vote. It's not like they're charging you 99 cents a minute like they did back in the old days with the hotlines. You can't scam people if you're paying money, but if it's all free, who knows? You know, who really knows what's legit and what isn't? I was shocked of those four choices that Undertaker and CM Punk didn't win. But who knows, maybe enough fans thought Rock vs. Cena was match of the year because that's how it was positioned. You know, the average fan, they care less about how good an actual match is than you or I would. So it's entirely possible that was the legit vote, it was the wrong choice, but whatever. The Shield was out there wearing black suits to present Double Cross of the Year. They did a very subtle tease during this segment of friction between Dean Ambrose and Roman Reigns. And then again later on during the Ambrose-CM Punk match, Reigns and Rollins were outside the ring. Punk got thrown out to the floor. Ambrose had the referee distracted. And they didn't touch Punk. You know, they let him lay there. And so Ambrose, I guess, was bothered by this. He's like, listen, I gave you an opening. You didn't take it. And he said, why don't you guys leave? I can handle things on my own. So as soon as he said that and the other guy started to leave, they went back inside. And, of course, Ambrose got beat because it seems like ever since he won that U.S. championship, Dean Ambrose is expendable. He can lose matches, and it's no big deal. And I argue otherwise. I say he's been losing far too often, and that's just another example of why having these secondary belts, especially that U.S. title, it's so damn useless. I mean, I mentioned it last week, and the more I thought about it, I'm actually in favor of the idea of unifying the two singles secondary belts also. Unify the world titles and unify the IC and US too while you're at it. Just have one intercontinental champion and just do away with the US title. All the WCW lineage stuff, just get rid of it because it's obvious they don't care about it. They don't respect it. So why even bother having that title? But anyway, so yeah, Punk won that match and you could see kind of the direction they're going in as far as planting the Roman Reigns seeds for a babyface turn and breaking up the Shield. They're doing the slow burn. And I want to mention this. One of our listeners, Nick Finney, wrote his name down here. He wrote in to suggest the idea that they, you know, stall out this Shield breakup. They don't do it right away, but they, again, the slow burn. You build it up until WrestleMania 30, and you build to a Shield versus Undertaker match. Now, as I said to Nick, I prefer a singles match for the Undertaker. With what few matches he has left at WrestleMania, I think the real money is in singles matches, Taker versus, you know, one person, whether it's Brock, Cena, Sting, I mean, whoever. I think if he's got two matches left, three matches left, they should be singles bouts. But I wouldn't mind this idea. If it had to be a multiple man match or a tag match or something like that, this is an idea that I could actually see. I think it could work. You know, Undertaker would still win, because I don't think the streak should end. I think he should retire unbeaten. But it can be the final straw that breaks up the Shield. You know, so if Taker beats all three guys, it's no big deal if they're breaking up anyway. And it could play perfectly into that whole storyline with Roman Reigns finally going babyface on Raw, let's say, the next night, much the same way that The Rock did on Raw the night after Backlash in 99, when the corporation turned on him. So the more I think about that idea, Shield versus Undertaker, WrestleMania, I don't know that that's the direction they're going in. I've read things that you've probably read the same thing about Brock Lesnar and The Undertaker, which is a big match. I'm not saying I wouldn't want to see Brock and Undertaker, but in terms of using some of the newer guys, the younger guys, it would make sense. It would make sense. It would help get all of them over just by putting them in a high-profile match like that at WrestleMania, the biggest show of the year. The last time we saw Undertaker, he got laid out by The Shield. I mean, The Shield were nominated for an award for putting The Undertaker through the announce table. And I've noticed on commentary more often the last few weeks, here and there, the announcers making mention of the fact that Shield put The Undertaker out. Last time we saw The Undertaker, he was laid out by The Shield. And it makes you wonder. You know, these things, I'm sure, are no accident. These lines are being fed to them. They're being told to say this. Maybe they are building up to an Undertaker-Shield match. Maybe they're going to save Brock for The Rock. Maybe The Rock's going to come back and we don't know it. I mean, that's part of the fun about guessing as far as WrestleMania matches is concerned. The more I think about Nick's idea and the reasons why it would make sense, I would be fine with that. I think that's the one multiple-man match for The Undertaker that would make sense and that would help. It would help get all of them over, even in defeat. And it would play into something long after Undertaker is gone, because he'll disappear the next night, and it could be the next phase of whatever this is that they're going to do with The Shield, the official breakup. You can drag it out. You can get a whole bunch of more months out of this thing if they could just be patient and build it up the right way. And then Roman Reigns, when the lid blows off this whole thing, he'll be a huge star. Ambrose, I think, will be a good heel. The one guy I'd be worried about is Seth Rollins. I think when this happens, whenever it happens, he's the one guy that if I had to worry, I'd worry about him. But, you know, not necessarily all three of them are going to go on to become world champions and big superstars. I think they all have the ability to, but it's Reigns and it's Ambrose, I think, are the two guys that I'm looking at as really being the big breakout stars of this group when it happens. And I think that'd be a good idea. We had another match between Miz and Kofi Kingston. For those keeping score, Miz was 100% heel this week on the show, which probably means that this Monday he'll only be about 70% heel. He pinned Kofi, hooking the tights. Kofi then kicked him in the face after the match and left him laying, so this feud must continue. The Rhodes Brothers, Rey Mysterio, and The Big Show all teamed up. Big Show, by the way, still showing no ill effects of the head trauma the night after Survivor Series when the doctors and the trainers had to come out. I was in the building that night. I had to help him up the ramp. He was all woozy. I don't think the announcers have even said anything about it since then. They haven't even given us a medical update on the guy. But he seems fine. But it's incredible to look back on all those weeks of television we had to sit through, which were seemingly building to a Big Show Triple H confrontation. People actually seemed hot for that. You know, there was that one Raw. Maybe was it the Raw where not the Raw where he came out in the truck. It was some sort of ceremony. Big Show ended the show, and Triple H was outside the ring, and he was teasing that he was going to go in and kind of build up the courage to stand up to the Big Show, but he didn't. And I remember the crowd was electric for the Big Show that night. You know, I will give them credit for that. They managed to build Big Show up enough to where he was the top babyface in the company about a month ago. It wasn't that long ago. And I think back to all that stuff, and now it's just ice cold. It's like it's completely forgotten. He got his job back, and it's like it never happened. It's amazing. Anyway, they beat the Real Americans and Rybacksel. Yes, Ryback and Curtis Axel. That is their new team name. You know the old expression, two wrongs don't make a right? Well, two losers don't suddenly make a winning combination either, but damn it, they're going to try. I guess they have to do something with these guys. It's a terrible name, Rybacksel. It's just awful. Even JBL was crapping all over it on commentary. Speaking of JBL, there was a priceless moment where Michael Cole said something to the effect of, since Ryback and Axel got rid of Paul Heyman, you know, as though they were the ones who kicked Heyman to the curb in storyline. And JBL picked up on this right away and very accurately pointed out that it was Paul Heyman who dropped the two of them. He dropped those two bozos, not the other way around. JBL redeemed himself this week. Last week, very overbearing. I was not a fan of the commentary. This week, he turned it around. And I wonder if part of that was, you know, Jerry Lawler was busy hosting the Slammies. He wasn't on commentary, so we're back to a two-man announce booth on the show this week. I don't know if that had something to do with it. It flowed a little bit better. Who knows? But there was another great JBL gem during the next match between Hunico Cara and Alberto Del Rio. And this goes to the heart of one of the many problems on Raw these days and these three-hour shows, the constant rematches. We had another Sin Cara-Alberto Del Rio match. We had another Miz-Kofi Kingston match. I've lost track of how many matches those two guys have had. It's the same guys every single week. Del Rio took a bad spill on a sunset powerbomb spot at the end of the match. He suffered a concussion. He still has not gotten clearance. I guess they're going to check him out on Sunday, the end of this weekend, and see if he clears the tests. So apparently this new Sin Cara is like a bizarro version of the old Sin Cara. The old Sin Cara would constantly injure himself, whereas this new Sin Cara now injures other people. JBL, in talking about Sin Cara, he actually said, "We're seeing a new Sin Cara here." This was when he was on a roll during the match. And I think he then realized what he said, and he tried so hard not to laugh. It was great. He may not have laughed, but I did. I have to say, that was a pretty funny line. Brodus Clay was out, which could only mean one thing. Main event time. He pretty much squashed Xavier Woods. Then he kept beating him up after the match. This may be... not officially a heel turn, but this was basically the heel turn right here for Brodus Clay. Tenzai had to hold him back. R-Truth ran in to protect Woods from more punishment. Then Brodus left talking about how, you know, he's the main event. If that's his new gimmick, I actually kind of like it. I like delusional heel Brodus. The dancing stuff is nothing more than filler at this point. It's time to move on. I don't know about this idea of bringing Xavier Woods up from NXT just to help get Brodus Clay over as a heel, but I like this segment. And I'm just going to move on here to the main event segment. Nothing else really mattered on this show. This was the difference here between being a good show as opposed to just being an okay show. Because other than this, there really was nothing exceptional about this Slammy Awards Raw at all. Nothing. It would have just been a, it's there kind of show. I see people raving about how good Raw it was. You know, don't let this segment fool you. As a whole, Raw wasn't great, but this segment was awesome. It was the championship ascension ceremony. Feels weird to hear Ascension on TV and not see Conor O'Brien and Rick Victor. I guess in due time we'll probably see those two guys. Triple H was trying to speak, couldn't speak. The crowd just completely drowned him out with chants of Daniel Bryan. They chanted yes. They did not give two craps about what Triple H was talking about here. And it was awesome because you have this ring full of former world champions. And I know Jack Swagger was in there and even Ziggler, who deserves better, but still, Dolph Ziggler has never, ever been treated as any sort of legitimate world champion. Literally, his first title reign was, what, 5 minutes? His second reign people will remember that Money in the Bank cash, and they will remember nothing about his actual reign, if you could call it that. But he was in there in Swagger. But you had guys like Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Mick Foley. I mean, there was, and of course, Triple H, you know, and you've got fair number of big names in there, CM Punk, all these different former world champions and WWE champions. And to see this entire ring full of people, and yet the one guy they're chanting for, and I know it was his hometown or home state or whatever, but they're chanting Daniel Bryan with all their might, with all the power their lungs can dispense. They're shouting this man's name. They're chanting yes. This went on for a good 2 or 3 minutes straight. Triple H had to stop his promo. I never thought I would ever figure out a way that you could get Triple H to stop cutting a promo, but this was it. We finally found the way. Now, if only we could replicate this week after week after week, it would be awesome. And Brian could not contain his happiness and his joy. He was laughing. He was clapping. He loved it. It was a great moment. Mark Henry raised his arm at one point, but he only did it to basically shut the crowd up. He raised Brian's arm, and then he lowered it, and he did the throat slit and said, okay, enough, and that only made them cheer him more. The crowd was sending a message. Part of it was they just liked Brian. You know, he's from Aberdeen, Washington. That was certainly part of it, but they loved this man. It was a total rejection, though, of the main storyline. You know, WWE, they go to a lot of hometowns of some of their superstars. Very few get the kind of reaction that he got on this show. So believe me, this went far beyond it just being a hometown pop for somebody like Daniel Bryan. Okay, they were sending a message here. Orton comes out, John Cena comes out, both titles. The whole point of the ceremony is they were hoisting both belts up into the air. It was the final time we were told we would ever see both belts together in a Raw ring ever again. And Randy Orton starts cutting a normal Randy Orton promo, which prompted chants of boring, which clearly irked him. And then he got some life in him. Maybe he was legitimately pissed off or whatever, but he points out, you know, Mick Foley's in the ring, and I took years off your career. I literally took years off your life, which he probably did. Then again, I can only imagine the number of years The Rock probably took off Foley's life with those chair shots at the Rumble. Still, it's hard to go back and watch that. He said he embarrassed Shawn Michaels a whole bunch of times. He said as far as Bret Hart goes, there would have never been a screw job in Montreal. If I were there, I would have left you laying flat on your back. It kind of lit a fire under him a little bit. And by the end, I thought his promo was actually, you know, pretty good, all things considered, by Randy Orton standards. And then John Cena took over and cut what may have been the greatest promo of his life. And in fact, I'll go as far as to say that it was the best promo of John Cena's career for 3 reasons. Number one, no comedy. He left the awful stand-up comic routine at the gorilla position, and he was focused. He was passionate. He treated the match at TLC like it was the most important thing in the world. It was everything that John Cena usually is not. Okay, he can be intense and he can be serious on these go-home shows when he has to be, but more often than not, we get funny John Cena, who may be the most hateable babyface in history. We didn't get that here. So that's number one. Number two, I have no doubt in my mind, with that promo he cut, he sold a bunch of pay-per-views at the end of the show. This was the go-home show for TLC, and they did an awful job of promoting that pay-per-view, aside from the main event. Awful! There isn't a single undercard match on this show on Sunday that I care about. I expect the Shield match to be good, but that doesn't mean I care about it or that they gave me a reason to. It's a 3-on-1 handicap match on pay-per-view. We have 2 of them, in fact. And it didn't help that when the show was over, people were more excited to see Punk and Bryan against some combination of Triple H, Shawn Michaels, and Randy Orton. They were thinking about the different scenarios for WrestleMania, not their matches on Sunday, okay? But with that one promo, John Cena sold pay-per-views this weekend. I don't know how many. God knows a lot of you guys who have emailed me don't trust this company after the last few shows, and you're not buying the show no matter what. I get that. I don't blame you. But he did about as good of a job as can be expected of getting people interested in this unification match. And that should be the goal. And number three, John Cena managed to turn himself from hated babyface in that building to beloved babyface in the span of about 5 minutes. If you believe that he called an audible while he was out there and he ad-libbed much of his promo on the fly because of the crowd reaction, that only makes it more impressive. You know, was he trying to leech off Brian's heat for his own benefit? Absolutely. You bet your ass he was. And he made Brian a focal point of his promo and pointed out that unlike Orton, Brian worked. He worked hard for all of his success. He earned it. He didn't have to have it handed to him like it was his birthright. And he mixed shoot elements into his promo. You know, how Orton was untouchable back in OVW because there were certain people who liked him, and that once he was on TV, he was sheltered by what Cena said, you know, in his own words, the best performer in the business. I don't recall Randy Orton ever being sheltered by Shawn Michaels, so surely he's not referring to Triple H when he says that. He talked about Orton having behavioral problems on camera, behavioral problems off camera, and then he pointed out that it was him. It was John Cena who gave CM Punk the title shot in 2011, where Punk beat him and became a big star. And he gave an opportunity to Dolph Ziggler when nobody else would. That was a year ago at TLC. He gave Bryan a title shot, and Bryan beat him too. And then he said that if he wins the title to TLC, he looks forward to the rematch with Daniel Bryan. And then he shook the man's hand. And the people roared with approval. They loved it. John Cena was like a fucking magician during this segment. He could have pulled that dead bunny rabbit I talked about in my NXT review last week out of a hat, and that still would not have been as impressive as what he did here, turning the crowd in his favor, using Daniel Bryan's heat to his advantage to get himself over and to get the match over on pay-per-view, which is what the singular goal of this segment should have been. So thumbs up to him. It was the best Cena promo I ever remember seeing. Things went straight to hell after that. Cena and Orton started brawling. The other former champions in the ring separated them. Orton, while being held back, pie-faced CM Punk, who started attacking the champion. Triple H saw this, and he threw Punk down to the mat. Punk got up and punched Triple H in the face, then immediately turned around, got super-kicked by Shawn Michaels. Michaels turned around. He got nailed with a flying knee by Daniel Bryan. The place just exploded. Orton tried to give Bryan an RKO. Bryan shoved him off. Orton ran over Stephanie McMahon by accident. Not the first time he's done that. Triple H ran over to check on his wife as Orton stood there shocked. And all I could think to myself when I saw that is, God, this really is 2009 all over again. Triple H laid out Orton with a pedigree, his music played to end the segment. I know. It is what it is. But they did leave us with a very intriguing shot of John Cena helping Kane and Triple H to assist Stephanie back to her feet, and all of them, the Authority and John Cena together, stood there staring down at Randy Orton in the corner. So they wanted you to think, or at least question in your mind when Raw went off the air, oh, is John Cena going heel? Is he going to join the Authority? Of course he's not, but they wanted you to believe that. So the whole thing, it was just total chaos. One of the best Raw finishes in years. It kind of reminded me of that one SmackDown ending just before they blew off the whole invasion in 01, where all the top guys just hit their finishers, one after the other after the other. It was one of the wildest endings to a show. I think it's actually up on YouTube. If you type in best SmackDown ending ever, it should be the first thing that comes up. This wasn't quite that wild, but this was pretty close. And what I also loved about it was it teased a bunch of potential matches for WrestleMania. There have been rumors of Randy Orton and CM Punk for the WWE title. Maybe CM Punk against Triple H. Shawn Michaels, what about him? You know, he may come back and wrestle Daniel Bryan. All of those are possible options. You know, again, I don't think Michaels is coming back, but nobody knows for sure. I think of the three, the most likely would be Punk and Triple H. That way, you have Bryan win the Royal Rumble and then challenge for the title of WrestleMania, which finally gives the fans the big payoff that they've been waiting for. And after the reaction he got on Monday, hometown or not, I don't see how you can't position this guy, if not to win the title, at least position him at the top of the card when it comes to WrestleMania season. He has to be in the mix. He can't be toiling with the Wyatt family or any of the, you know, other mid-card acts or feuding with corporate Kane because of their history as Team Hell No. That cannot be the idea for Daniel Bryan over the next few months. And this solidified it. This to me should have been all the proof that they need that this guy has to be in that main event mix, whether it's for the title or not. And I think it should be for the title. I think people feel cheated out of the happy ending that they were expecting and hoping for in the Bryan storyline. And sometimes you just have to give the people what they want. And it's interesting to me when you think about this whole thing, because you can have Bryan win the Rumble, challenge for the title of Mania, but you can also, you know, give Punk that WrestleMania main event that he's always wanted. It's the one thing that he said it before. It's the one thing he has left to do that he's never done before is wrestle in the main event, the last show on the card at WrestleMania. And he could do that against Orton. You know, Punk wins the Rumble, And instead, I guess maybe you do Daniel Bryan and Triple H, with Bryan going over on him and proving, you know, hey, I'm not a B-plus player after all. I'm an A or an A-plus or whatever. But then the problem with that is John Cena is the odd man out, unless they do the Undertaker match with him and Cena, and I don't think they're going in that direction. So personally, if it's me, I prefer to see Bryan win the Rumble instead of Punk. But the point is, they got people talking, and they have a few different directions they can go in. So this was great. And I hate to even bring this up, but enough people ask me about it. These online reports of mass chaos backstage after Raw last Monday, heat on John Cena, all this nonsense. You know, Bret Hart is upset because Randy Orton mentioned Montreal and Bret didn't know it was coming. Right, like the other 25,000 times they've mentioned Montreal on TV. It's funny to me how all these people were so upset that they spent another 25 minutes after Raw went off the air entertaining the crowd and entertaining themselves, doing spin-a-roonies in the middle of the ring. Stephanie McMahon came out and did a spin-a-roony, and CM Punk did a spin-a-roony in his underwear. You know, she stripped down to his skivvies. Oh, yeah, I could tell. They all look so pissed off. You know, Vince McMahon was probably upset by the crowd reaction, I would imagine, to the final segment. He shouldn't have been. I mean, maybe it deviated from their script, but if I'm the owner of the company and I'm, you know, I got my TV show on and the crowd is reacting like that, I'm smiling from ear to ear. If I'm a promoter, I die for a reaction like that. You know, sometimes you just got to roll with the punches. He should be fortunate that enough people care that much about any of the guys on his roster. They have so few actual big stars these days compared to any other period in the company's history. If you've got a guy who's that over, I don't care where in the country you are, you should be thanking your lucky stars. Because you've got a million other wrestling promoters knocking down your door, from Dixie Carter to everybody else to the smallest indie out there, who would die to have somebody that over and to have a crowd reaction that awesome, because it just makes your show feel hot. And Raw wasn't, I mean, overall, Raw was not a hot show on Monday. Raw was just another show until that last segment, and it was largely because of the reaction that Bryan got. So if Vince is pissed, I think he shouldn't be. I don't see why he should be. And Orton, yeah, I mean, Orton, I'm sure, wasn't thrilled to hear boring chants during his promo. But you know what? Other than that, I find this all to be quite comical. Punk did post a tweet, I will say. He posted a cryptic tweet on Thursday saying, "It's difficult to always try to do business the proper way with a company that refuses to practice the same standards." I don't know what he's referring to. I don't know what he's talking about. He's talked openly about retiring in the next year or two. A lot of guys say that. I remember Booker T talking about all the knee injuries he had and how he was looking to hang it up in the next 2 or 3 years, and that was like 9 years ago. And you can go through a whole laundry list of different examples of wrestlers who say shit like that, and they actually stick around for another 5 or 10 years. You know, he's vented on Twitter before, Punk has. Like when WWE did nothing to promote the fact that he was going to be appearing on Talking Dead. Remember that whole thing? I think it was last year. Talking Dead is the Walking Dead wrap-up show on AMC. It goes on right after Walking Dead ends. And Punk was on there as a guest, and WWE didn't say a word. They did nothing to promote his appearance on there. And Talking Dead, on most weeks when it's on, does better ratings than Raw does. Raw's on the air for 3 hours, right? In theory, it's all action, right? Lots of great matches. Talking Dead is an hour, and back then I think it was half an hour, of a bunch of guys sitting around on a couch talking about the TV show that just ended, and it was pulling like 5 million viewers. So it's a big deal. And they did nothing to promote it, and that pissed off Punk, and rightfully so. And I think there was some parade that Punk was going to be the Grand Marshal in Chicago, and WWE did nothing to promote that. So, you know, he's had his issues with the company before. He's a moody guy. This is hardly a revelation. I don't see where this is breaking news. So that is true. But all these other reports, to me, I read this, and I just think to myself, complete BS. I don't think there's anything to it. So, tables, ladders, and chairs. Big pay-per-view this weekend from Houston, Texas. We'll start from the bottom, work our way up. Dolph Ziggler and Fandango has been announced as the kickoff match. No idea why, just two guys that they have nothing for. They just decided to put them together. I'll go with Dolph Ziggler. I don't think he can possibly sink any lower than he is right now. So I'll go with him. We have the Divas Championship on the line, AJ Lee and Natalya. I would not be surprised to see Natalya win the title. I really would prefer they keep the belt on AJ. I would keep the belt on AJ through WrestleMania and just hope that by WrestleMania time, whether they bring up somebody new or they build up somebody currently on the roster, they build them up to a point where people actually want to see AJ get beat for the belt. Because AJ is still, even though she's a heel, she's very over with the crowd, I think, by and large. She was in Seattle. I could tell you that. A lot of pissed off people that she didn't win that Diva of the Year award. And I don't think there's anybody in her league right now. Natalya's a great wrestler, but as far as a character on TV, I would keep the title on AJ, but I feel like with this total Divas stuff and they're promoting the show and AJ's had the belt for a while, I'm going to go ahead and say that she loses it. Natalya is my pick. I figure she's winning the championship. Goldust and Cody Rhodes against the Real Americans, Big Show and Rey Mysterio, and Rybacksel for the Tag Team Championship Fatal 4-Way match. I assume it's Fatal 4-Way. I don't remember them saying it was an elimination match. Maybe it isn't. Maybe it's one fall. Big Show and Rey, they're the walking wounded right now. Big Show's knee is bothering him. Rey Mysterio's knee, obviously, is still bothering him. There were reports from the building on Monday that, you know, after he tagged himself out at the beginning of that 8-man tag team match, he was walking, you know, he walked halfway up the aisle, shook things off, was adjusting his knee brace. So being in a tag team right now is probably the best thing for both of them, even though it's a big step down for the Big Show from where he was even a month ago. I'm going to go with Goldust and Cody. I still think it's too early to take the titles off them. If you go back a couple of months, I laid out my entire idea, if I were booking a storyline idea, to build to Goldust versus his brother at WrestleMania next year, which I think is what they're going to end up doing anyway. But I did this whole segment outlining my idea for it, and my idea was they hold on to the titles until, I think, after the Rumble is what I said. So I think you could still get another month and a half out of them as tag team champions before they drop the belts, and that can kind of play into the tension that builds between the two, and then they end up wrestling each other. So Goldust and Cody retain here is my pick. Big E Langston defends the Intercontinental title against Damian Sandow. I'm going to go with Langston. Too early to take the title off him. Daniel Bryan against the Wyatt family in a handicap match. I'm going to go with Daniel Bryan here. I know they've been teasing a heel turn or some sort of turn to the dark side. Bray's like, I can make you a monster. And I wouldn't mind seeing a harder edge to the Daniel Bryan character. I'm kind of curious to see where they go with this or if they just drop the whole thing. But I think Bryan's winning. I do think he's winning this match. On the other hand, I think Punk is losing in his handicap match against The Shield. I'm going to go with The Shield here in their 3-on-1 match. And then the main event, Randy Orton and John Cena unification match. They've guaranteed when the pay-per-view is over, we will have one single WWE champion. And I do believe that that champion will be Randy Orton. Randy Orton is my pick. I don't buy into this baloney that there's tension between him and the Authority and they're trying to pretend like, oh, maybe he's on the outs with Triple H and Stephanie. Maybe Cena's going to be their new face. I don't buy it at all, and I'm sure we'll all find out on the pay-per-view Sunday that that's, in fact, not the case. So however it happens, whoever may interfere, I don't see there being a completely clean finish here. It'd be kind of nice if they went out there for 25, 30 minutes, had a kick-ass match with a totally clean finish, and Cena going over. Because then we can get the Cena-Bryan match that Cena kind of teased. I'm thinking Cena probably teased it because he's losing. And maybe they'll do that match somewhere down the road, Cena versus Bryan again. Maybe it'll be WrestleMania, who knows. But I got to think that Orton's winning the match here. And that's the card. That's tables, ladders, and chairs. If you were bamboozled into buying the last three or four pay-per-views and you're not ordering the show this weekend, I understand completely. I don't blame you at all. I do think that Orton and Cena are going to have a really, really good match. I really do think they realize they have to go out there and just steal the show and just put the best match on they possibly can. The fans have felt ripped off after the last few pay-per-views, and they really have to bounce back and give people a reason to believe them again, to believe them when they say there will only be one champion when this pay-per-view ends. So I can't tell you to spend your money on this show. I can't do that. They've got a lot of work to do to regain the trust of their customers. But I do think Cena and Orton are going to go out there and have a really good match. WrestleMania 31 officially announced at a press conference this week from Santa Clara, California. The date will be Sunday, March 29th, 2015 at the brand new Levi's Stadium, which is not even done yet. Philadelphia, nobody to blame but themselves for not getting the show. They never submitted a formal bid for WrestleMania, but they had a shot. I guess they didn't think they could go the extra mile to make the scheduling work and free up the arena next door for all the other events that are associated with Mania, Raw, Hall of Fame, all that stuff. And WWE reportedly did not appreciate their lack of enthusiasm. So, sorry, Philly fans. I guess there's always 2017. The other big news to come out of this concerns the WWE logo. Now, the logo they use in the WrestleMania 31 logo here at this press conference was noticeably the same one they used for the network when they first started teasing the network. I mean, God, it's probably been almost two years already when they first started teasing that network. And according to Stephanie McMahon, that is the new logo they're going to start using going forward. That's the new scratch WWE logo. And I hate that logo. It looks like someone with glaucoma was just supposed to touch up the original Scratch logo in Microsoft Paint, and we ended up with this. But that's the logo we're going to have to get used to. I don't know why you would change it, personally. I mean, either just use the Scratch logo, which is a good logo. I think it looks nice. And if you're going to change it, just go all the way and just come up with a completely different WWE logo that actually somehow incorporates the E. Because to them, you know, the E is the most important thing. They don't give a shit about wrestling. It's all about the entertainment, and it's always been funny to me that the Scratch logo has no E. It's two W's and a check mark. So if you're going to change your logo, I'm kind of shocked that they wouldn't somehow come up with something completely new to incorporate the E into it, or just keep the damn thing as is, because it's probably going to cost them a lot of money when that day comes if they completely revamp the logo. And they already went through that once, you know, a decade ago. I don't know that they want to go through that whole thing again. NXT this week, I just have to say, I did not like it. They can't all be winners. Not every episode is going to be a home run. It was a boring show. There was really no forward advancement of any kind. Nothing really happened on NXT this week. The Ascension beat Hunico and Camacho in a tag team title match. The Ascension bores me. At one time, they were a really intriguing act, a dark act. I had people emailing me wondering if there could be some association with The Undertaker. Now I think back to those emails and I just laugh. If I need a good laugh, I think back to that idea, this notion that the Ascension would come up to the main roster and would somehow work a match or work a program or even form a stable with The Undertaker. Because why? Because they both have blue lights. The Ascension is boring. There is no depth to the characters. We know nothing about these two guys. Their matches are boring. And at one point, maybe I was kind of excited and was hoping they would bring them up to the main roster when they needed tag teams. Now, we've got so many tag teams, makeshift tag teams, actual tag teams, that I don't care one way or the other whether they bring these two guys up. So when you take the Ascension and then Hunico and Camacho, who were good wrestlers, you know, they're fine, but these two teams together, it just bored the shit out of me. And anyway, the Ascension won. They retained the belts. Alexander Rusev beat Cassius Ohno, so Cassius Ohno is still popping up on NXT every week, which just goes to show the poor planning here as far as firing the guy and how much of an impulse decision it probably was, because you'd think if they knew they were getting rid of him, they wouldn't keep him on the next 4 weeks of television. So he keeps popping up and depressing the hell out of me every week now on this show. Rusev beat him with his camel clutch move. He refused to let go. Finally, the hot blonde with him, Lana, told him to let go, and he let go. So maybe that's part of their gimmick going forward. She controls the monster. And speaking of Rusev, Rusev worked the dark match before Raw in Seattle last Monday. I think they called him Andrew. I don't know if that was a mistake or if that would be his name up on the main. I don't know why they would change it from NXT. I'm guessing it was probably just a mistake. So I think the fact that he's working dark matches now is a good sign for him. And I would say he will be on TV sooner rather than later. And I got a question about Rusev in the mailbag, and I get into him a little bit more later on. So you'll want to check that out, because I think how they handle this guy's debut is very important. Obviously, it's important to him. You want to make a good first impression. And I have an idea on how they can do that. So I'll talk about that later on in the mailbag. We got a recap of all the Antonio Cesaro stuff, him and Byron Saxton bullying him the last couple of weeks. And then we saw William Regal at the announce desk, looking very stern, very serious, and he basically says, hey, if Antonio has a problem with me, there's no need to take it out on Byron, I'm right here. And they left the camera on him for a little bit, and then they cut away and they moved on. So again, the slow burn. I like this. I like that it's building to a Cesaro-Regal match because I think it'll be a great match. It's just this old school kind of way of building up a feud between these two veterans. So I like it. The BFFs, Summer Rae and Sasha Banks, beat Bayley and Natalya. Remember a couple of weeks ago I mentioned that Bayley teased having a mystery partner in a tag team match. Wasn't much of a mystery. They had a backstage segment earlier on the show where Natalya's walking down a hallway and she just sees Bayley sitting on a bench by herself. And she ends up offering her services as her tag team partner, and that's how they became a team. So that was kind of a letdown. And the BFFs won. I believe Sasha pinned Bayley. Not much to it, which is kind of the theme, I think, of the show this week, unfortunately. Mojo Rawley beat Scott Dawson, another guy who is out. I think he suffered an ACL tear, had surgery, but I guess this was taped just before he got hurt. So Mojo beat him, and Mojo's finisher sucks. I've said this before. He's got the earthquake splash, and I know that he's got this great vertical leap. He's a big guy, former football player, and he can leap very high into the air, but it's a shitty move for somebody like that. Unless you're 400 pounds or 500 pounds, jumping up and sitting down on somebody's chest is not an impressive finishing move. So this man needs to find himself. That's the whole point of being in developmental. Somebody should pull him aside and say, listen, we got to get you a different move. And just do it already, because he looks so ridiculous when he does this. But he won the match. Afterwards, Dawson attacked him. He left him laying. I guess the two of them were probably supposed to feud with one another, but with Dawson getting hurt, I guess that's not happening now, which means this also is not going anywhere. Main event was Leo Kruger beating Sami Zayn with the slice. Turned him inside out with that clothesline. Kruger went for another one after the match. He wanted to add some insult to injury, but Zayn ducked it. Kruger headed for the hills. Zayn caught him with a somersault to the floor, and we went off the air with referees pulling the two of them apart. So Sami Zayn, who debuted not all that long ago, a few months ago, and was on a pretty decent run for himself. He wasn't undefeated or anything like that, but he was winning a lot of matches. The fans were really hot for Sami Zayn. He became the top babyface on that show once Big E Langston officially parted ways, I guess, with the NXT faithful and went full-time on the main roster. And now you see that they're giving Zayn the classic WWE treatment. He's lost the last probably three or four matches he's had. And this one was a clean loss, you know, fair loss. There was no interference, no chicanery or anything of that nature. Leo Kruger just beat him. Leo Kruger, a man who, based on some of the recent NXT shows, it looks like has dropped the Leo Kruger name. I think the name he was going by was Adam Rose, a different look. Now, I don't know if that's part of this storyline they're building on this show where he wants to become one of the real Americans. You know, it's like he started attacking Sami Zayn as a way to get in the good graces of Antonio Cesaro in the hope he would become a real American, like Zeb Coulter would initiate him. And who knows, maybe the Adam Rose changeover is part of that whole thing. But it sounds to me like they just completely dropped the gimmick. And if you've got a guy where you're dropping his gimmick and you're trying something new with him, why the hell is this guy beating somebody like Sami Zayn, who's the most over babyface you have? It doesn't make sense to me. So Zayn has, he's still popular, but it's almost like they're trying to go out of their way to cool him off a little bit. That's just what they do. And that was NXT this week. Not a good show. The streak has ended. We had three really, really great shows. This one, not so much. I would still say, check out the show. If you're going to start for the first time, do not start with this week's episode. Go back 3 or 4 weeks and start with that. It's still, for the most part, a really fun show. It's free. You can find it on Hulu Plus. But this week was a thumbs down. Impact. Before we get to Impact from this past Thursday, I want to talk about AJ Styles. This is a big story that broke earlier in the week. PW Insider was the website I first noticed to break the news that AJ Styles, it would appear, is done with TNA. They could not reach an agreement on money. Of course, it always comes down to money. I got to tell you, when I first read this, I was shocked. Because even last week, when I was going over some of the spoilers for the upcoming shows, which AJ is involved in, AJ is going to be on TNA television in some form or fashion at least through the second week of January. Okay, that's how much TV they've taped already. And I don't want to get into the spoilers here for the people who don't want to know, but you look at some of the things they did, and in one respect, looking back now, it kind of does make sense why they did what they did, but just his level of involvement, this is the top babyface in the company. Everything has been built around this guy for the last few months. They've been doing this storyline with him and Dixie, where he's the champion, and she's trying to get her belt back, and we have these Friends of AJ vignettes. He's literally been going all over the world to Mexico and Japan, defending the title. Everything's been built around him. The one-year chase just for him to win the belt in the first place. He is the face. You know, we get all this nonsense about who's the face of the WWE, and I say, who cares? Who's the face of TNA? The face is AJ Styles. He's the poster boy. He's been there since day one in 2002. He is the most important person in that company as far as the top stars that they have. He's the one most associated with that company. He's the one who's gone out there and has busted his butt for them and had some of the best matches in TNA history. And for a company that spends so much money and time and effort on guys like Hogan and Flair and Sting and Kurt and everybody else, and Kurt Angle deserves credit because Kurt Angle also has gone out there, and I think Kurt's been maybe the one ex-WWE guy who has done the most for that company. He's now spent more time, Kurt Angle has, in TNA than he ever did with WWE. Some people may not realize that. He has broken his body every bit as much for them as he ever did for Vince McMahon. And he deserves a lot of credit. But I look at these other guys and the money they were probably paid and the attention that was paid to them. And now it comes time for them to pony up. And AJ wants more money. I can understand that. Now, is he asking for a ridiculous amount of money? That I don't know. That would just be speculation. Based on what PW Insider and other reputable sources have said, he rightfully wanted a raise over what he was making now. How much of a raise? I don't know. What TNA was offering was less. And then there were reports that they were offering the same amount. But if they're offering less, you know, from a pride perspective, even if this guy's not going to go to WWE, it's like any other job. I mean, it would be hard to accept that kind of thing and just be like, okay, I guess I'm just going to make less. This guy's been there for over, 10 years now. And if anybody deserves it, it's AJ Styles. And the fact they're not willing or able to pay this guy to keep him, and he's probably as good as gone, it just goes to the heart of what Dixie's been talking about in some of these recent, everything's fine, we're cash flow positive, and trying to paint the rosy picture of TNA. If they let AJ Styles go, that's all the proof you need. What more evidence do you need that this company is having money problems? The one guy they could not afford to lose, it looks like he's as good as gone. Technically, the extension that he signed in his contract isn't up until Monday. So there is still time for them to reach an agreement, for AJ to blink in this game of chicken and say, okay, I'll sign. Unless that happens, as of Tuesday, the 17th, he's free and clear to go where he wants to and do whatever he wants. And I don't think that includes WWE. I personally don't see them rushing out to sign this guy. If I'm them, I would. But that's not how they do things now. And this is one of the things that sucks about there not being a WCW anymore. As much as WCW sucked at the end and probably deserved to die, it sucks that we don't have that one other big wrestling company that at least makes Vince McMahon sweat. Not even necessarily makes him scared, keeps him up at night, but makes him sweat. TNA doesn't make him sweat. And they'll never make him sweat, no matter what happens. It's just not going to happen. They're far too big. Nobody, I don't see anybody, ever, able to sprout up from the ashes, whatever company it may be, whatever year it may be, that's ever going to give WWE a serious run for their money. WCW did. They were the biggest. They had their shot. They blew it. They died. And that's it. And now this other company is so freaking huge. I mean, it would take years and years and years for another company to come along and just build up enough of a profile to really give them a run for their money. Or somebody like Jeff Bezos or, Bill Gates or somebody would have to be like, oh, I'll get in the wrestling industry and put $50 million into a company. That's the only way Vince will ever feel threatened. And it sucks because if this were 1998, a guy like AJ Styles breaking away from, let's say, WCW, Vince McMahon would personally meet with that guy the next day. That's how Chris Jericho got signed. Chris Jericho, in the grand scheme of things, was a bit player in WCW. He was a mid-card guy. He had a lot of fans, but he was a TV champion. He was a cruiserweight champion. U.S. title at the most. That's how they positioned him. But Vince heard the cries of the fans to sign this guy, and I remember Vince McMahon went to Oxford. I remember this. He went to Oxford to speak to the students there, and there was at least one student who asked him, and you could check the timeline on this. I don't remember exactly when he went to Oxford. This had to have been sometime within the first 6 months of 1999. And they asked him, are you going to sign Chris Jericho? When are you going to sign Chris Jericho? And Vince responded to that person and said, hey, I'm working on it. So Vince was in the trenches. He was working. I mean, this is a mid-card guy. But he heard the fans. You know, he knew that this guy had a following. He was popular. He was talented. He did what he had to do. He got him signed. Jericho had this great debut. Now, how they treated him after that is a matter of question. You know, he went from a verbal duel on Raw with The Rock to feuding with China and losing to a woman on pay-per-view. But in the end, things worked out well for him. But that was 15 years ago. And if that were AJ Styles, he'd make this grand debut. He'd be on Raw within a few weeks, probably in a verbal segment with CM Punk or John Cena. But those days are done. Those days are over. And that's a big part of what made wrestling fun and exciting, and it sucks. So it's really a shame. And a guy like AJ Styles, he's a talented guy. He's already 36 years old. He's not getting any younger. If I'm WWE, I make a play for him. I don't send him to NXT. It'd be nice for them to sign him, meet with him, and come up with a plan to debut him, you know, even before WrestleMania in the next few months. And maybe AJ Styles can have a big match on the WrestleMania card. I mean, I know it sounds ridiculous. Why would they do this to a, you know, with a TNA guy? Forget the fact that AJ was a TNA guy. He's a talented wrestler, and he's got a fan following. But do I see that happening? No, I don't. So he may be perfectly content to just go do his thing. He's got a speaking tour he's going to be doing. That's the new thing in wrestling. Everybody now has a speaking tour. Everybody has a speaking tour, a podcast, and a GoFundMe or a Kickstarter or whatever. These are the new fashionable things, I guess, if you are in pro wrestling or if you're an ex-pro wrestler. But he's got a book coming out, so he'll be going on a book tour. You know, he'll keep himself busy. Maybe he'll work New Japan. I mean, who knows? So I think, you know, AJ will be fine. He'll find things to do. He could probably make a lot of money on the indie scene. Maybe go back to Ring of Honor. But if I'm WWE, I snatch this guy up, and I laugh in Dixie Carter's face and say, how could you let this guy go? The face of your company, and you let him go. You let him walk away. And yet a guy like Sting, and I like Sting. But the question now is Sting going to re-sign? And by all accounts, Sting is probably staying with TNA. If they haven't already, they're going to offer him a new deal, probably for another year, and they're going to keep him on. And I don't know if that money is coming from TNA or if that money is coming from Spike TV. But to me, it doesn't matter. You're willing to give Sting the money that he's looking for to keep him around, but you're not willing to go the extra mile for AJ Styles. That just seems wrong to me. Impact this week was all about Rockstar Spud driving down to Gainesville, Georgia to look for who else? AJ Styles. Still the TNA World Heavyweight Champion as of right now. So the Rockstar Spud skits were some of the highlights of the show. I thought he did great. I actually like the role that he's in right now. I just like the fact that Rockstar Spud's actually on TV. He's one of those guys. He won the British boot camp show. You know, it's like these gut checks that they did, right? All those guys that won gut check. How many of them actually are on television right now doing anything? Very few. But Rockstar Spud, they found a role for him. It works. He's a really small guy. So he can't believably be wrestling, for example, for the TNA World Heavyweight title. And in the X division, he's just another guy. So they actually found a role for him where I find him entertaining. I thought he actually was one of the highlights of the show this week, even though some of the skits were goofy. But I thought he did fine. And that's one of the things I want to give credit to TNA for. With a guy like Spud, with a guy like Sam Shaw, who they're starting to roll out the vignettes for his debut. I don't quite know the character that he's going to end up playing, but from the skits I've seen with him and Christy Hemme, and I didn't see another one this week, so I'm going off the one I saw the week before. He's just this very kind of evil, possessive boyfriend type, we'll see how that character kind of manifests itself once he actually debuts on TV. But they're trying. You know, Sam Shaw's one of the few gut check guys they kept around. They're actually going to do something with him. EC3, I'm not the biggest EC3 fan in the world, but they're trying. They're trying to do something with him. So I do give them credit for that. Kurt Angle destroyed the Wheel of Dixie. He deserves another gold medal for that. He was in the opening segment. He wanted Bobby Roode in the worst way. There ended up being a brawl. Roode gave him a low blow, left Kurt laying, and then he said, well, Kurt, you made a comment during the segment here about how, you know, you're sure you can not only beat me, but beat me twice in one night. Well, why don't we have a 2 out of 3 falls match? And so they're going to have a 2 out of 3 falls match on Impact next week. It's the final resolution. What do they call them? Free pay-per-views for free on Spike TV or some BS like that. So we're going to get that match. Eric Young and Joseph Park beat Bad Influence. And I mention this because at the end of the match, Eric Young took the mic and looked into the eyes of Joseph Park, who was bleeding just profusely. And Eric Young is the one who busted him open. He was trying to knock some sense into Joseph Park. Joseph Park was feeling sorry for himself, and he was trying to wake him up. He put Joe Park in a headlock at one point and used his bare knuckles to bust him open. And that, of course, turned him into Abyss, and he won the match. And Eric's looking at him dead in the eye and saying, you know, Joseph, the reason that you haven't been able to find your brother Abyss over the last 18 months is because you are Abyss. So that was the big reveal. After a year and a half, Eric Young in a promo just says to him, you are Abyss. And he dropped the mic and he walked out. And you could see Joseph Park mouthing the words, no, I'm not. So this storyline isn't over yet, but this was the first time they've acknowledged on television that Joseph Park is likely Abyss. So at least they're finally going to give us some sort of closure. I will be very sad to see the Joe Park character go away. I know it's been played out. It's probably gone on for far too long. But I like the guy. A character that I actually have an emotional attachment to. And they're going to get rid of him. I don't care about Abyss. Maybe they could still find a way to keep him around. I don't even know how you go back to Abyss. If you're acknowledging that Joseph Park is Abyss, you're just going to put the mask back on him? Maybe we're going to end up with some sort of hybrid of the two. Maybe he'll just, I don't know, be Chris Park, which is his real name. I don't know what they're going to do here. But the idea that he's just going to go back to being Abyss to me is kind of silly. If he wears a mask, I mean, we already know what he looks like. So I guess we'll see what they do here. EC3 had his first interaction with a main event performer. Sting came out to confront him. He said, listen, you've proven nothing so far. If you really wanted to prove something, you'd enter yourself into the Feast or Fired match later in the show, or you can just fight me. And EC3 teased that he was going to fight Sting, and then he changed his mind and said, all right, I'll be in the Feast or Fired match, and he walked out. So Sting's still around. He's not doing much. They want to keep him. They're willing to pay him. He can't ever wrestle for the world title again, but he's still around. I guess he'll just work with some of the younger guys, put them over. Gail Kim and Lady Tappa were out. Gail Kim said, who's next out for my open challenge? And out came ODB. ODB said, I don't want you. I want Lady Tappa. And a big brawl broke out. And Madison Rayne made her TNA return post-child. She had a baby a few months ago, so now she's back. And she's looking good. I got to say, you know, Madison Rayne's a pretty woman. Apparently she's a bodybuilder. She's done bodybuilding competitions before, which kind of surprised me when I read about that. Maybe it was her hair. She had like long brownish hair. She looked good. And she went after Gail Kim for reasons that they didn't bother explaining, because the last time we saw Gail Kim together on television with Madison Rayne, they were not feuding. They were best friends. And then Madison got pregnant and she went away, and all of a sudden she's attacking Gail Kim. So maybe Gail Kim didn't give her a baby gift at the baby shower. Maybe that's going to be the storyline. I don't know. But they were rolling around there for a bit. Jeff Hardy and Magnus are going to compete for the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. This is kind of like if this were UFC and AJ Styles was out injured. These two guys would be the ones wrestling for the interim title. That's the only way I can really equate this. So they had dueling promos back and forth. They were good. You know, they built up the importance of why it means so much to them to be the TNA champion. And Dixie Carter was out there with them. And she said that the match, because God forbid we should have a straight singles match between these two guys in the finals of this tournament, it has to have a stip. So the stipulation is going to be that it is a Dixieland match. And a Dixieland match is a match where it starts inside the steel cage. You have to climb out of the cage and then go down the aisleway, and on the stage at the top of the ramp is going to be a ladder. And hanging above that ladder will be the TNA Championship belt. And you have to grab the belt. And then and only then will you win and be declared the new champion. This just seems awfully stupid to me. She said that her VIP table will be open later in the night, and it would be wise for one of you boys to come join me. And so that was the, I guess, storyline for the remainder of the show. They had a segment with Magnus at one point, who teased getting a phone call. They wanted you to think that it was Magnus who was going to go join Dixie for some dinner and some wine. And in fact, we found out at the end of the show that it was Jeff Hardy who showed up to meet with Dixie. So intrigue, trying to build intrigue here. Austin Aries beat Chris Sabin to win the X Division Championship back. So this is, I think, probably Aries' second or third X Division title. And, you know, I watch Austin Aries, and the match was good. It wasn't great. It was good. It was only about 6 or 7 minutes. Aries, to me, is like CM Punk. He's the CM Punk of TNA, in that the guy was a main event player. He was a world champion. Now he's been knocked down the card a little bit because they don't have anything for him on top. The fans still like him. They still cheer for him like he's a main event guy, but he's not. He's not positioned where he probably should be. And they're both very talented guys, both very outspoken guys who aren't always the easiest to deal with. So I look at Aries a lot like the CM Punk of TNA. Or maybe you could say CM Punk is the Austin Aries of WWE. Whatever floats your boat. Ken Anderson came out for the Feast or Fired match, but he got attacked on stage by Bully Ray. Bully Ray gave him a pile driver on the stage, and then he started reciting poetry verses to him. He said that Anderson raped him of his future, and again brought up the fact that Anderson's wife is pregnant with twins. Let me just say this first. I like that Bully Ray is taking his character in a different direction. I think it's welcome. He has to get away from the biker aces and eights crap. Okay, so that's good. But I'm a little uncomfortable with him constantly using the word rape in promos where he also talks about Anderson's pregnant wife. I know he's not saying he's going to rape her. He's using that word to refer to himself. But there's no way that it's a coincidence. He's using that word in the same promo where he's mentioning the man's wife. I just think they need to tread lightly on this one. Just be careful. Then came one of the dumbest matches TNA has ever created, Feast or Fired. I was only half paying attention to TNA back in the day when this match was first created during Vince Russo's run there. And you could tell it's a Russo creation because the only kind of match better than a match with a pole is one with four poles, which is what this was. Get a briefcase in each corner hanging from a pole. Ethan Carter, Chavo Guerrero, Zema Ion, and Gunner all took briefcases here. Match also included Hernandez, Samoa Joe, Chris Sabin, Austin Aries, Dewey Barnes, Norv Furnum, and Curry Man, who immediately walked out of the match, therefore making him smarter than the other 10 idiots in the ring. The announcers tried to explain that he didn't want to take the risk of being fired, and that's why he left. And they never bothered to remind the audience that Curry Man was once in a Feast or Fired match and chose the wrong briefcase and was fired as a result. Would have been nice for Mike today to mention that, but he didn't. Why would anyone volunteer to be in a match where you have a 25% chance of being fired? For what, an X Division title shot? Even dumber is that they make you wait until next week to find out who pulled down what briefcase. But, you know, then again, back when they used to do these matches on pay-per-view, they would also make you wait until the show on Thursday to find out. So imagine how happy I'm sure that must have made fans who paid money to see that match on pay-per-view to find out, hey, want to know who's getting fired? You got to wait until Impact. At least people didn't have to pay for this. I didn't read the spoilers for next week, but I'm guessing here, EC3 gets the world title shot, Zema gets the X Division shot, Gunner gets the tag title shot. And they tease further dissension with him and James Storm. James Storm had the briefcase in his grasp at the end of the match, and Gunnar knocked his partner off the ropes. And, you know, James Storm was sitting crotched on the top rope, and Gunnar not only climbed over him, but he stepped on him when he went to go take the briefcase down himself. So if they win the tag title shot, you know, they can build further attention and finally break the two of them up, which seems to be the direction they're going in here. And I figure Chavo probably gets fired because, let's be honest here, I'm sure 80% of the audience probably figured he was already fired until he showed up here on the show. So that was Impact. I like the Rockstar Spud stuff. Not much else. Let's get to the mailbag. If you have questions, you can email them to me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. You can send audio questions in as well. I know we got a couple of audio questions this week, but we're not going to use them. The quality, sound quality, really was not what it needed to be. So try to make sure when you record these things, 30 seconds or so, MP3 format, that you speak up and it's of a good enough quality to air here on the show. And always include the text of your question as well in the email. And please include your name and where you're from when you write in. Brad in Connecticut, he's up first. Am I being overly cynical in thinking John Cena made sure to ask Daniel Bryan where he was from during his promo on Raw so that everyone watching knew it was a hometown crowd for Bryan, attributing to how over he was during a segment that was really intended for Orton and himself? Not that those chants wouldn't have happened elsewhere, considering how over Bryan is, and Cena did give a great nod to Bryan's work ethic and the fact that he beat him clean, but my first thought was, yeah, way to demean this awesome fan reaction for a guy who is crazy over, hometown or not. Maybe I am just way too cynical. Also, as much as we keep having horrible endings to pay-per-views, I'd love the titles to not be unified at TLC for whatever reason. Once again, be held in abeyance and have the winner at the Royal Rumble become the unified champion. The tension when it was down to the final four would be awesome, and hopefully Bryan and Punk would be two of the four. That would be a pretty cool ending to the Rumble. I think the Rumble would be that much more exciting if you had the championship on the line in the Rumble and it came down to Cena, Orton, Punk, and Bryan. Because normally, somewhere in that final mix of four or five guys, there's at least one or two who you know have no shot of winning. But if the title was on the line and it came down to four guys who all four could conceivably walk out as champion, I think you could have one of the more exciting Rumble endings in history if you did it that way. But they can't, because they need to deliver a champion on the show this week. I mean, they can't do that. They cannot give us another screw job. They would be complete fools to do that. So as cool as that would be, it's too late. They could have built it up that way, I guess, but now they can't. They guaranteed a winner, and they have to give the people a new champion at TLC. As far as Cena on Monday, I think you're being too cynical here. I think that's where the John Cena hate goes over the line, and it's just like, come on. Him mentioning his hometown simply to point out the fact that, you know, the only reason he's getting this reaction is because he's a hometown boy, and going out of his way to demean him. He did the exact opposite. I thought Cena handled it about as well as he could, and if anything, he went out of his way to do just the opposite and make Bryan out to be the biggest star they got, and he didn't have to do that. So I give John Cena a lot of credit. I didn't look at it that way at all. Zlatko from Bulgaria writes in with a question about his fellow countryman, Alexander Rusev. I've recently started watching NXT on a regular basis. After hearing that Rusev has started wrestling in dark matches, I've been completely marking out, but I'm also a bit worried. Every time I watch any of his matches on NXT, they seem to be devoid of any crowd heat. The people just do not react. My question is, how would you debut Alexander Rusev on the main roster, and what would you have him do to get over? Should he bring his valet with him or cut his own promos? I've thought about this since I got the question, and I've heard very little of Rusev's promos on his own. You know, he comes out, he screams, he grunts, he speaks in Bulgarian in some backstage segments. So I don't know how good he is on the microphone by himself. Lana is the name of his valet on NXT. I can take it or leave it with her. You know, if he's shaky on promos, it might be best to use her or just get another mouthpiece for the guy. Someone new like Rusev, I think, would have been better served to be paired off with somebody like Paul Heyman instead of Ryback, because Ryback was already dead by that point. It was a waste of Heyman, as we now see. That whole thing was a complete waste of time. So I do think he should have somebody with him, and the way I would debut him is actually very simple. I'll use two other debuts to illustrate my point here. At the Slammies last year, Big E Langston laid out John Cena. Okay, this was when Cena and Ziggler were about to have their big ladder match at TLC. Maybe it was after that, but I think it came before. But that was a year ago, and that was Big E's big debut. Hell of a debut, right? Can't make a much bigger impact than laying out the number one guy your first night in. The problem with doing something like that is that unless you plan on keeping this new guy in the main event mix right away, which is very rare that they do that, there's nowhere else for the guy to go but down. If he's beating up John Cena on night one, what happens on night two? You know, did Langston go ahead and feud with John Cena? No. He became Dolph's bodyguard, and after Dolph's big win over Cena at TLC, his career hit the skids until he cashed in Money in the Bank. And where's Ziggler now? He lost to Curtis Axel on main event this past week. Langston, you know, at least Langston is finally getting a push. He's got the Intercontinental belt. He's doing okay. But it's a year later. And for much of that last year, he did nothing. He even disappeared off TV for a couple of months because they didn't know what to do with him. I think the better way to go would be to look at Brock Lesnar's debut in 2002. It was the night after WrestleMania. There was a mid-card hardcore match going on. People were probably only half paying attention. And suddenly, over the barricade hops this gigantic beast of a man who runs into the ring and destroys anything that breathes. And the stuff they did with him annihilating Spike Dudley was genius because it illustrated how massive of a man Brock was and how small Spike was. And then we saw Paul Heyman outside the ring directing traffic, which caught people's attention, because Heyman had been banished ever since the invasion ended, and they brought back Jerry Lawler to be in the announce booth. So a combination of all those different things made Lesnar's debut one of the more memorable ones in company history. And he didn't beat up Steve Austin on his first night in. He beat up a bunch of mid-card guys who they could afford to beat. You know, made Brock look strong. And then from there, he worked with the Hardys. He worked with RVD. I think he may have beaten him to become King of the Ring. And they built him up until he was ready for the title a few months later. He started on the sixth floor of a 28-story building and worked his way up to the penthouse on the top floor, instead of starting on the roof and then getting moved down to the basement. That's how I would book Rusev. Save his debut, if he's ready, for the night after WrestleMania. It's one of the biggest Raws of the year. You're guaranteed to have a hot crowd on that show. Everybody's going to be watching that show. And let's say you've got Kofi Kingston versus The Miz, part 593. Taking place in the middle of this three-hour show. All of a sudden, this giant man leaps over the barricade with Heyman or Lana or whoever right behind him. He's standing there. He's psyching himself up. Fans are standing now because they see this massive person just hopped over the barricade. They have no idea who he is. Maybe there's a few, you know, pockets of fans who do watch NXT who know, and they're cheering. And he goes into the ring and just destroys Kofi and Miz or whoever. I'm just using them as two mid-card examples. Just destroys them. That's the key. Whatever he does, it's got to look impressive. And then he stands tall with his hand raised, and now you've made an impact. And he can start working his way through the roster. Beating up John Cena on day one does more harm than good. You've got nowhere to go but down. At least this way, he's got room to move up. Maybe he goes unbeaten for a while. That's how I would do it. I know Triple H's edict supposedly is that most of the guys they bring up, you put together vignettes for them and you build up their debut for several weeks, Xavier Woods being the exception. And that's fine. But that doesn't mean you can't still bust out a surprise every now and then to shock the crowd. And the night after WrestleMania would be a great time to do it. David Ashcroft from Manchester, England. He was the first person to send me a link to that Cats on Donut shirt I mentioned on the Sound Off during my NXT review a few weeks ago when I saw Bayley wearing it. Apparently they sell it through Hot Topic. I haven't bought it, but I'm considering it. He says, I don't think any of us believe that WWE has been planning a slow build to Daniel Bryan finally getting his real title win at WrestleMania, but given the end of the Slammy Raw, it's insane if that is not going to be what they build to now. So, if Bryan wins the Rumble and Cena unifies at TLC and retains at the Rumble, there is still a chance for Cena to drop the title to Punk at the Elimination Chamber. My question is, despite the fact that Punk and Bryan for the title at Mania is many fans' dream match, and as a fan of Punk, I so badly want him to get his Mania main event, which do you think would be better? The chance of Punk and Bryan having a five-star match to end Mania, or Bryan finally getting the title with another win over Cena in what would round off an 8-month story for both Bryan and Cena, and also representing a passing of the torch? That is a great question. I've thought about that, and my answer might surprise you. I would give the edge to a John Cena-Daniel Bryan match over CM Punk-Daniel Bryan. I have no doubt that Punk and Bryan would go out there and have a 5-star match. When they feuded for the WWE title last year, they had some awesome, awesome matches. Their match at Over the Limit in May, where they had the double pin finish, was great stuff. And the fans ate it up. It's not like all these guys are doing chain wrestling and the fans are sitting on their hands. The fans were into it because you had two guys that the fans were into. Bryan was probably still a heel at the time, but he had his fans. Punk was very over. And the fans appreciated the match. It was great stuff. And then they had another two or three matches, and those matches were great too. So on a stage like WrestleMania, the main event, and Punk has been, you know, like the person said here, like David said, he's been itching to get that WrestleMania main event for so long, I'm sure they'd go out there and tear the house down. But in terms of a WrestleMania main event, there are certain elements that I, as a fan, would look for, and just having a great wrestling match is not enough. It has to feel like a big-time WrestleMania main event match. The crowd reaction is a big part of that. It has to have like a big-time feel worthy of a WrestleMania main event. And I just feel like with Bryan and Cena, there's a great story there, if they want to tell it, of Bryan, after basically being handpicked by John Cena for a title shot. Right? Remember when Raw was in Brooklyn? Night after TLC, I wasn't there, but place was going nuts. They were begging John Cena to pick Daniel Bryan as his opponent for SummerSlam. And he handpicked him. He just said, okay, I've selected Daniel Bryan as my opponent. And it's not like Bryan didn't deserve it or hasn't worked hard for it, even in storyline. But in storyline, he just went, I pick you, you get the title shot. And there really wasn't anything more to it than that. So to go from that, and then winning the big one, and then having it snatched away, and then getting screwed over at every turn and told, you're not good enough, you don't deserve it, you haven't worked hard enough for it, and doing something that nobody has done before, and going on to then beat John Cena for a second time, twice in a row, clean. But this time, when he does it, he'll do it having really earned it and fighting his way through the Authority and Triple H and Stephanie back to the top to become a worthy champion. Like, that's the story I see in my head whenever they do that match, whether it's WrestleMania or whenever, provided that Bryan wins. Maybe Cena wins, even Steven booking, has to get his win back. I don't think he should win. But I like that story. And I think back to the match at SummerSlam, and that was in Los Angeles, and the place was, it was nuts. It was crazy. I would have loved to have been there. Obviously, they were largely for Bryan. Cena had his fans, but there was never a dull moment. There was never a quiet moment during the match. The place was going crazy. It was high energy. That's what the WrestleMania main event should be. The WrestleMania main event, and we've had a number of these before, should not be a match where the Undertaker match on the undercard stole all the heat and all the thunder from the main event guys. So now the main event guys go out there, and the crowd is like half dead. I hate when that happens. And it's happened a whole bunch of times. It happened this year. You know, Cena Rock, I mean, I guess, you know, they got their reactions, but after Punk Undertaker, the crowd was spent. So I'm thinking in my head, who could we put out there that would have the crowd amped up, on their feet, get a great reaction, and still give them a great match? I thought John Cena Daniel Bryan had one of the matches of the year in WWE. If it wasn't the match of the year, it was probably number two or number three. I'd probably go with Punk and Lesnar above them. So it's not like these guys can't go out there and have a great wrestling match. John Cena probably have his working sneakers. I was going to say boots, but it's funny to think of John Cena wearing boots. He'd probably have his working shoes on, trying to do hurricanranas, which he probably shouldn't do. He looks pretty bad when he does it. But I could see these two guys going out there and having a classic match. And if Cena puts him over a second time, especially if he taps him out, I don't expect that. He'd probably beat him with the knee again. But could you imagine if he actually did tap out to the S-lock? It goes against everything the John Cena character is about, never give up and all that crap. But however he does it, for Bryan to beat Cena a second time and then win the title on the grand stage of WrestleMania and not worry about a Money in the Bank cash-in or anything like that and get his big moment, if that's the story they end up telling, that's a great story. And it's a great redemption for the Bryan character. Punk and Bryan, it's a great match. And it really isn't much more than that. And it's probably a match between two babyfaces, unless somebody goes heel before then. And, you know, whenever you have a match between two babyfaces who the fans love equally, you run the risk of the reactions kind of canceling each other out. I don't know if that would happen with Punk and Bryan. Cena's a babyface, but half the crowd hates him. So he's, you know, it's almost like he's a heel. He's part babyface, part heel. It's just such a weird thing with Cena, like the reactions he gets. I know people crap all over him, and there are a lot of elements to his character that I absolutely detest. I'm not the biggest fan of the John Cena character at all. Anybody who listens to my show knows that. But you can't deny the fact that when he goes out there for some of these matches, and he's in there, let's say, with a big babyface like Bryan, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun just to listen to the crowd, let alone, you know, the match itself. So of the two, if you gave me the option, big-time WrestleMania match, John Cena, I know he's always in the main event. You get sick and tired of that after a while. But big-time WrestleMania feel, WrestleMania 30, I would go with Cena-Bryan. I think that's the stronger, bigger match. And I think that handshake that we saw between them in the Ascension ceremony on Monday night could have been the first tease of that. It could have been the first tease of a WrestleMania match between the two of them. Andy from Portland, Oregon. I was in Portland last year for the first time. Nice city. Happy birthday to Andy, by the way. He says, I have not read Hardcore Holly's autobiography, though it is on my list of wrestler books I need to read. And this question is probably already answered in the book. Why did he have a match against Brock Lesnar at the 2004 Royal Rumble? I am a Hardcore Holly fan, going back to his super heavyweight days. I remember the build-up with him brutally assaulting Big Show with a lead pipe and thinking, is this the push? Was this management's way of giving him a massive push as a result of him allegedly getting injured at the hands of Brock? I did a 45-minute review of Bob Holly's book on my YouTube channel, so you can find it on there. I did that a couple of months ago. It's an excellent read. I highly recommend it. The match with Brock was born out of Bob getting his revenge for Lesnar breaking his neck. That was the storyline. It was a revenge program. And in the book, he says that, you know, Brock wasn't happy about wrestling him. You know, not because he hated Bob or anything like that, but obviously you're the WWE champion and you're defending your title on pay-per-view against a guy who's been low to mid-card there his entire career. It's understandable that he's going to feel that way. But they did the match anyway, and he said they were told they were going to have 15 minutes for their match at the Royal Rumble. They got to the gorilla position. They were about to go out there, and somebody came up to them and said, okay, now you've got 8 minutes for your match, including entrances. Because Shawn Michaels and Triple H, who were having the last man standing match on that show, I guess to blow off their program, needed that extra time. They wanted that extra time so they could go long. And Bob doesn't hide his true feelings in the book. He thought that was very selfish of them. You know, here you have two guys who need all the help they can get this match over, and you give it to two guys who already have had a million matches together by that point. You know, maybe WWE didn't think he was worth it, but, and he points this out in the book, you are what you make me. That was an expression that he used. Had they done a good enough job of building Holly up as a viable challenger for Lesnar, and the crowds seemed to be into him when he first came back and went after Brock. You know, I went up on YouTube and I looked up, there was a Survivor Series match in 03. It was like Team Lesnar against, I already forgot what the other opponents were, but Holly was in there. He got DQ'd early on. They wanted to keep them apart as much as possible for the eventual singles match. If he then went on TV and beat some real names, people would have taken him more seriously as a threat instead of one jobber beating another jobber, which is basically what it was. They gave him wins over guys like Matt Morgan and A-Train. Everybody beat those guys. Nobody cares about Matt Morgan or A-Train. I mean, what else did they expect? Holly in a title match was going to be a tough sell no matter what. But they didn't do themselves any favors in how they booked the guy leading up to the Rumble. So they had one of the shortest WWE title matches in pay-per-view history. I talked about Big Show and Big Boss Man a few weeks ago, I think during the This Week in History segment. I actually love the storyline. It was so tasteless, but it was so freaking funny and entertaining. And the Boss Man, it was all because of the Boss Man. But when they came to the Armageddon pay-per-view in 99 and they had their title match, it was one of the worst god-awful matches I've ever seen. And it was one of the shortest title matches on pay-per-view they've ever had. It was literally like a 4 or 5 minute match. This one only went a little bit longer than that one. This was one of the shorter matches in pay-per-view history with that title on the line. And Brock won, and that was that. That was Bob Holly's big main event push at the beginning of 2004. Kent from Philadelphia. I like the old blue-style steel cage, as it seemed to have a harder impact than the mesh design they've been using for about 15 years now. Cage matches today don't seem very imposing as they once did, not to mention the sound the old blue cage would make when somebody slammed their opponent into it. The cage today doesn't sound like anything. Maybe the Hell in a Cell made them change it, or maybe the mesh cage is just easier to assemble than the old blue one. If you watched the St. Valentine's Day Massacre pay-per-view back in 99, Austin vs. McMahon used a black-colored one. I really wish they would use that design, but maybe it's better to use the one they have now as it seems safer, and we have to keep in mind the safety of the talent. That first of all, that is true. That's exactly why they use it. But let's not forget here, wrestling promotions, including WWE, back in the WWWF days, they used the mesh cages all the time back in the 70s and the early 80s. You know, it wasn't until the Hulkamania boom in the mid-80s that they introduced the blue bar cage, probably because it was easier for big guys like Hogan to climb. In fact, I wouldn't be shocked at all if you can trace back the first blue bar cage to a Hogan match and they specifically did it so that he could climb it. Wouldn't shock me at all. But I remember even after Hogan first won the title in 84, I guess it was, he wrestled guys like Beefcake and Don Morocco. I have an old Hulkamania, I think it was Hulkamania 6. They did these Coliseum videos back in the day. And my father actually bought it because I remember having this video since I was a little kid. And on that video, there was a cage match against Beefcake and Don Morocco. And it's inside the mesh cage. There's no blue bar. You know, but I did grow up on that blue bar cage, though. It is my favorite. And it does seem like it would be much easier to climb. But like you said, the reason they stopped using it was guys were complaining that they were getting their ass kicked. It hurt. That's why they stopped using it. You bang your body against that thing, and it's going to kick your ass. It's no fun. I climbed that thing myself at the fan fest they did. The very first fan fest WWE ever did was back in 94 at Madison Square Garden down in the rotunda of the building. And or maybe it was upstairs, but they called it the rotunda anyway. They had one of the blue bar cages up as part of, like, yeah, you know, it's part of the display. And I started climbing it until I got yelled at, and they told me to climb back down. But that shit hurts. So you're right, it was a safety thing. But I wouldn't be opposed to busting out the old blue cage when they do those old school Raw shows. Why not have a steel cage on one of those, you know, episodes and use the old blue cage for one night and just be safe? I think once every now and then is fine. Cole from Philadelphia, two Philly fans this week. I know it's fun to make fun of Luis, the original Sin Cara, for his consistent botching, but Junico is botching moves as well. My point is, before Luis and Junico donned the Sin Cara mess, they were amazing workers, so shouldn't fans in WWE take into consideration that maybe it's the mask and the stupid Sin Cara lighting that's hindering these two men's eyesight, which is the reason their work rate is suffering so much? Well, is Sin Cara now with Junico botching moves? I haven't noticed him botching moves. I think it's just the cool thing to say that Sin Cara is botching moves. It's you know, people think it's funny. He's only been Sin Cara for a few weeks. I don't remember him botching any moves. What, because Del Rio got hurt on Monday? I mean, that could have happened on any sunset flip powerbomb. It's not like he botched the move. The whole point of the move is you do the sunset flip and the guy goes backwards. Unfortunately, this time the guy happened to hit his head and he knocked himself loopy. It's not his fault. But, yeah, I mean, the original Sin Cara, unfortunately, became known for fucking up moves. And people started making fun of him for it. Now, is it because of the lighting and the mask? I'm not under the mask. He wore a mask in Mexico as Mystico. That, if you look at it, probably would have been hard to see through that, too. This mask is really no different in that respect. It's not like he went from not wearing a mask in Mexico to wearing one in WWE. He's worn a mask his whole career. Why all of a sudden would it be difficult for him to see? And the lighting, I hate the lighting. The lighting is stupid. I guess their idea behind the lighting is it makes him a special performer. It keeps the focus on him. I think that's a load of crap. I think it just, A, pisses some people off, and the other fans who aren't really bothered, they're kind of indifferent to it. It's not making them pay any more attention to his matches. They're dead silent for his matches. It's like a Japanese match, only unlike Japanese crowds, when he wrestles now, people aren't really paying attention and, you know, busting out in cheer whenever he does a big move. In Japan, it's a respect thing. Here, they just don't care. So I think that's a cop-out. I don't think that has anything to do with it at all. Nor do I see Hunico botching moves left and right so far. I don't know where you're getting that from. I think what happened is this guy came up from Mexico. He's working in a different environment. He's working with new workers. Remember, there was a story where they were bringing up another Mexican talent named Averno. He and Averno worked together a lot. He was comfortable working with him. He went to WWE and said, sign this guy so I can work with him. And they were going to bring him up. And I don't know if they ever officially signed Averno or not, if he ever signed on the dotted line, but Sin Cara got hurt, and he was out for a while. That may have been when he messed up his knee at Survivor Series, and he was gone for like 8 or 9 months. So they never brought Averno up. And that may be part of the problem. He wanted to work with a guy who he's comfortable working with. Well, that's fine if you're going to work one program with him, but what happens after that program runs its course? You're going to have to work with some of these newer guys. You're going to have to work with the American guys. And then there's the ring. You know, the ring in WWE is probably a lot bigger. I think it's 20 by 20. I don't know what the ring was down there in AAA or CMLL. I'm sorry. I think he was in CMLL. So I think that probably is the biggest reason. He's a talented guy. He was the John Cena of Mexico. A lot of people don't realize that. He was like the John Cena of Mexico for a good 5 or 6 years. He made millions of dollars. He was unbelievably popular. He was an amazing worker. If you go Google him, put him on YouTube and bring up some of his old matches as Mystico. He was incredible. Like Rey Mysterio was incredible back in his day. He was a one-of-a-kind special performer. At least down in Mexico, that's what Mystico was like. And then he came here, and it's almost like it was a different person, but it wasn't. It was the same guy, but it's a different atmosphere, a different ring, a bigger ring, new opponents. The lighting and the mask, I think, has nothing to do with it. Finally here, Shady in Valencia, California. What do you think could have been the biggest potential match for each era? The Golden Era, New Generation, Attitude Era, Ruthless Aggression, that did not take place for some reason. Match that did not happen, if we're counting guys that were in WWE at that time, not fantasy interpromotional stuff, Hogan versus Flair, I think, would probably be the biggest from that golden, or like later on in the golden period. I mean, it happened. Hogan and Flair had some house show matches, but never on a grand scale. They never had a TV match or a pay-per-view match, so I think Hogan versus Flair for sure. Hogan versus Bret at SummerSlam 93. That was kind of the tail end of the so-called golden era, just before that new generation period launched. I think of the new generation era in WWE when they were branding it that way. That's like 94. But you could probably go back to 93 with that. And Hogan versus Bret was penciled in as a SummerSlam main event. Two big baby faces, Hogan from the previous generation. Bret was first starting out as the big baby face for this new generation. That would have been a huge match, I think. Bret versus Luger as well during the new generation period. It looked like we might get it at WrestleMania 10. They did the double title match thing where Luger got the first shot against Yokozuna and the winner was going to face Bret. Yoko won. We never got that Bret versus Luger babyface match. I think that would have been a big one. Shawn Michaels and The Rock during the Attitude Era at some point I think would have been a big match that we never got. We were robbed of that one. Hogan versus Austin in 2002 and in 2006. Because remember, on that Raw Homecoming show at the end of 05, they sent Hogan out there to cut a promo, and he did a tease for a possible match with Austin. Austin did not know that in advance. He was not happy, nor did he have any intention of wrestling Hogan. So there were two different times where it looked like maybe we would get it, like when Hogan first came back in 02 at the NWO, but they did Hogan Rock instead. They had multiple chances to do that match, and they never did, and that would have been probably the biggest match. Of all the ones I'm mentioning here, that would have been the biggest that they could have done that we never got. Austin and Bill Goldberg, they missed each other by one day. when Goldberg finally came to WWE. Austin wrestled what turned out to be his last match against Rock at WrestleMania 19, and Goldberg debuted on Raw the next night. So they just missed each other. Hogan versus Cena is another one that was rumored for WrestleMania 25. And I think they would have done that had Hulk not gone and messed up his back. There have been a bunch of matches that didn't happen in WWE in each era, but I think those would be some of the biggest ones.
History has been made here!
42 years ago, this week in wrestling history, December 13th, 1971. Pretty important date in Japanese wrestling history. WWE Hall of Famer Antonio Inoki was fired from the Japan Wrestling Association after planning a takeover of the promotion. Kind of backfired on him. Following year, Inoki founded New Japan Pro Wrestling, which is still going strong today. Some might say is actually the best wrestling promotion in the world right now in terms of talent and match quality. Giant Baba also left the JWA to form All Japan Pro Wrestling the same year. And without its top two stars, JWA folded pretty quickly after that. 27 years ago this week, on December 13th, 1986, in a match between the British Bulldogs and the team of Don Morocco and Cowboy Bob Orton, Randy's dad, in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, the Dynamite Kid suffered a nearly career-ending back injury. He did come back from it, but he was never the same. There is actually fan cam footage, if you've never seen it, of the match up on YouTube, even way back in 86, and the exact moment the injury took place. It's not like it was a big bump or anything like that. Dynamite hits the ropes. I think it may have been Morocco out on the apron, delivered a knee to the back, barely even touched him. He talks about it in his book. It wasn't anything that happened in this particular match or that spot. It was just a combination of abusing his body in the ring for so many years with his high-flying style, all the steroid use. He was roided to the gills. It just caught up with him. You can tell he's obviously in pain when he goes down. He crumbles to the mat. Nobody realizes how hurt he really is, so the match just goes on. He somehow manages to tag out to Davey Boy, and he spent the rest of the match laying on the apron. They had to bring a stretcher to the ring to cart him off. He had surgery to repair two torn discs in his back. He ended up with really bad nerve damage. The guy was a trailblazer in wrestling. He inspired a lot of guys, including Chris Benoit, who idolized Dynamite Kid and emulated his style. The diving headbutt off the top rope, which Benoit used, now Daniel Bryan uses it. Davey Richards is a guy today who I watch, and when I watch him, he reminds me of a Benoit Dynamite type. I don't know what that means for his body long term, probably not good. But the style there is very similar. And he looks, I think physically, he just looks a lot like those guys. Dynamite's been in a wheelchair for many years now, paralyzed, I believe, from the waist down. He suffered a stroke about a month ago. Actually, not even a month, probably about 3 weeks ago. You don't hear many good stories about him as a human being. He may be one of the most despised men backstage in wrestling history. But in the ring, he was one of the best. He really was. The very next day, on December 14th, 1986, Saturday Night's Main Event was taped to air on, I believe it was the first Saturday Night's Main Event to air in 1987, with the famous cage match between Hulk Hogan and Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff for the WWF title. That was the match where they each climbed out over opposite sides of the cage, climbed down, both men, their feet hit the floor at the exact same moment. They showed replays, there was controversy, so it was a tie, and they restarted the match. Hogan won, but that's a very famous match. Probably the most famous match the two of them ever had. 25 years ago this week, on December 13th, 1988, the AWA held its one and only pay-per-view show, Super Clash 3. How many of you guys remember watching Super Clash? I never did, but I wonder how many people listening have memories of that. They hosted it as an inter-promotional event with World Clash Championship Wrestling. It's the Von Erichs promotion. Both promotions were already far off their peak from years earlier. Show only drew about 1,600 people. Since we're in the spirit of title unifications right now, we had one here on this show with Jerry Lawler, who was the AWA World Champion. He beat Kerry Von Erich, who was the reigning World Clash Champion, to unify the titles. Lawler won the match on a ref stoppage due to excessive blood loss by Von Erich. Interesting little backstory to this, and this goes to show you how petty wrestling can be, especially back in the day when you had all these companies feuding with each other. And to this day, you'll still hear the odd story every now and then of one indie promoter doing this kind of thing to another. But allegedly, the WWF tipped off the Illinois State Athletic Commission that there was a really old statute on the books that said amputees cannot compete in championship matches. And believe it or not, that was actually a law on the books at the time. It might still be, for all I know. They claim that Kerry Von Erich was an amputee, which he was. He lost his foot in a motorcycle accident, but it wasn't common knowledge in wrestling until later on. Not a lot of people knew about that fact, that the guy was an amputee. And anyway, they argued the match should be canceled. Just a real scumbag move all the way around. Between revealing he was an amputee and then trying to get the match canceled, commission said it wouldn't even start investigating things until after the pay-per-view date, so WWF just dropped the whole thing, and the match took place as scheduled. 20 years ago this week, on December 13th, 1993, in a match taped in Poughkeepsie, New York, at a Monday Night Raw taping, although it did not air until the day after Christmas, on WWF's All-American Wrestling Show, Alundra Blaze, the former Medusa Miceli in WCW, beat Heidi Lee Morgan in the finals of a tournament to win the newly reinstated WWF Women's Championship. The title had been retired since 1990.
Hi, I'm Alundra Blaze. The WWF just finished the Women's World Championship Tournament. It has come down to the last two women, myself and Heidi Lee Morgan. A very good wrestler. I have enough confidence to be the champion. Alundra Blaze, I went through the same women you went through. You think you're going to walk out of this tournament being the champion? I think not, Susan Clay. I am going to be the World Wrestling Federation champion, just to watch and see.
Blaze held on to the title for 342 days straight before losing it to Bull Nakano in a match in Tokyo. Almost 2 years to the day after winning it here, she would show up on Monday Nitro and drop the belt in a trash can, which pretty much turned out to be a metaphor for her career after that. 16 years ago this week, it was December 11th, 1997. One of the more famous episodes of Raw is taped in a small auditorium in Lowell, Massachusetts, although it would not air for another 10 days or so. Compare this with Nitro, which was live at the time and preparing for the big Starrcade match between Sting and Hulk Hogan, and you can see why WWE was getting its ass kicked at the time. Commissioner Sergeant Slaughter astutely pointed out that Shawn Michaels had yet to defend his European title a single time, and so he would do so on this show against fellow DX member Triple H as a way to drive a wedge between the two men. This after they came out to open the show wearing bathrobes, which they removed to reveal jock straps with mistletoe hanging from them. Their match consisted of a comically long crisscross spot and Triple H giving Michaels a big splash to win the title, making a mockery of the entire thing. We also had the very first singles match between The Undertaker and The Rock, who became the Intercontinental Champion via forfeit like a week or two before this, after Steve Austin refused to do the job for him. Speaking of Austin, they also aired a segment that was taped the week before with Stone Cold delivering a stunner to Santa Claus. They air this episode of Raw every year around Christmas time on WWE Classics. They have it up right now, actually. It's kind of become a tradition that will end this year since Classics is going away at the end of January. 14 years ago this week, on December 12th, 1999, this is a big one here. This was the Armageddon pay-per-view. We got nudity on a WWE show. Miss Kitty won an evening gown match in a swimming pool to win the women's championship, after which she yanked off her bra and revealed her puppies to the world. Just ripped it right off, and there they were. This wasn't like Sable that one time where she had paint on her breasts, or Jacqueline on that UK-only pay-per-view when her top got ripped off accidentally. I just used air quotes when I said that, by the way, accidentally. I'm not even sure why I'm using air quotes since you can't see me. Anyway, Sergeant Slaughter was on standby with a towel, covered her up pretty quickly, and she later apologized for the stunt. I don't buy for a second that wasn't planned. No way they keep that camera on her like that if it wasn't. Chris Jericho beat Chyna to win his first of what would later become a record 9 Intercontinental titles. The Big Show beat the Big Boss Man to retain the WWF title. I just talked about this a moment ago. One of the worst pay-per-view title matches in company history. Main event was Triple H and Vince McMahon in a Falls Count Anywhere match. Stephanie McMahon was seated in the front row. This only weeks after being drugged and marrying Triple H against her will. This was Stephanie's big heel turn. After Triple H pinned Vince, the two embraced. And the rest, as they say, is history. 14 years later, we now have the authority to deal with on TV every week. This little plot twist, this angle, you could argue, changed the entire course of WWE history. I have no doubt that if Triple H and Stephanie never get together, as they ended up doing because of this storyline, that Shane McMahon is probably the one being groomed to run the company right now, not Triple H. 12 years ago this week, on December 9th, 2001, Chris Jericho became the first ever undisputed WWE champion, beating Steve Austin and The Rock in back-to-back matches in the same night. So I mentioned a little bit earlier the AWA Super Clash, that title unification, this title unification, all of this is quite timely with the TLC pay-per-view tonight. And 5 years ago this week, on December 14th, 2008, Jeff Hardy beat Triple H and Edge in a three-way at Armageddon to win his first and only WWE title. He would drop it a month later back to Edge when his brother Matt turned on him at the Royal Rumble, a spot that was originally earmarked for Christian's return, but when word leaked, Vince freaked out and changed plans. Christian ended up debuting on the ECW brand instead. And that's what happened this week in wrestling history. If you have questions for the mailbag, please email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @Solomonster. I'm always tweeting on there and live blogging during the pay-per-views, Monday Night Raw, Impact on occasion. Facebook, we're all over Facebook. Profile page, fan page, and you can also subscribe to our closed discussion group. Just type in the full name of the show. It'll come up. You'll apply for membership, and I will approve you. Solomonster sounds off. Just type it in there. You can subscribe to us in iTunes. You can download our free app in the Google Play Store for those of you with Android devices. You can stream us on Stitcher Radio, which I would be most appreciative of. And you can also vote for us. Nominate the Sound Off in the 2013 Stitcher Awards. You can go back to the beginning of the podcast to find the website where you can do that. And subscribe to us on YouTube. The Solomonster is my username on there. And you can make a PayPal donation to The Sound Off always on thesolomonster.com. You'll see the box in there. I really thank people at the beginning of the show every week when they make a donation because it does mean a lot to me. And I know little shout-outs like that mean a lot to a lot of them as well. So if you want to make a donation for a shout-out, if you just want to make one to show your support for The Sound Off and keep the show going as is, thesolomonster.com is the place to do so. We will be back with a normal show, episode 306, next weekend. So until then, be well, stay safe. We're counting down the weeks until 2014. Going to be a new year soon. And hopefully you guys will join me for it. Until then, take care, guys.
You've been listening to The Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Because I'm the man!
You don't shut your mouth, I am going to punch you in the face.
The bad.
You're going to prove to the world that all you are is a B-plus player.
And the ugly.
And then Hogan announces that he's going to defend the championship, Bully Ray is, against the same Sting who just 3 months ago lost a match where if he lost, he can never again get another title shot. What in the fuck just happened?
Well, mostly the good.
I can't get a break with Ace's names. I got to get rid of this match. I got to get this club. This club sucks.
The Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes, The Solomonster Sounds Off.